Here on FM, it's Comandante by Rory Carroll. The traumatic events of 2002, when Hugo Chavez was briefly ousted from the presidency, led the Venezuelan to look harder at who were his friends and who were his enemies. Our book of the week is read by Jack Claff.
The crises of 2002 sent the Comandante ever more often to the Sala Situacional, the Situation Room, beneath his office. Guards at the door. Infrared swipe cards, no windows, a rectangular room filled with computers and trusted military and civilian aides. Restricted access meant even most ministers had no idea what it looked like, fueling speculation about its size and influence. The Comandante fed the aura, but the reality of this mysterious chamber in the first few years was rather mundane. About 15 people reading newspapers and magazines online and in print, clipping, pasting, noting, archiving. Others seated before televisions and radios, monitoring the airwaves' ebb and flow. Gossip columns, public announcements, and intelligence reports were filtered to create files on governors, mayors, journalists, business leaders, and trade union activists. I loved it. There was a real buzz working down there. We had a great team, everybody with their own job and rhythm. Every day we updated profiles on the main players. Whenever Chavez visited, we were able to immediately brief him on who was doing what. The man speaking had been one of the Sala's senior analysts. In a low, even voice, he told his story. Andres had been a few years behind Chavez in the academy, and went on to become an instructor in political science and geopolitics. Left-wing and despairing of Venezuela's exhaustion, he had participated in the 1992 coup and afterward visited Chavez in jail. After Chavez's election in 1998, Andres helped set up the Situation Room. It swiftly matched the mood and pace of the chief upstairs, he recalled. Working all hours, responding to requests for this and that, trying to keep one step ahead, jubilant, anxious, frenetic, in a symbiotic relationship with the Comandante. And then, after the April 2002 coup, it all changed. It became something else. Andres paused. I can sum it up in one word, he said, leaning forward. Fidel. Fidel Castro had long dreamed of co-opting Venezuela and its oil wealth into Cuba's revolution. He had supplied weapons and training to Venezuela's doomed guerrillas in the 1960s, then, in a pragmatic switch, made peace with successive presidents right up to and beyond Chavez's 1992 coup. Castro initially condemned the uprising, but 2 years later, when Chavez was pardoned and freed, he invited him to Havana. Fidel was in the midst of a crisis. The Soviet Union had disintegrated, and with it the subsidies that had kept Cuba's economy afloat. Against this background, Castro invited a semi-notorious Venezuelan ex-coup leader with no money, no political experience, no organized support, and it seemed, not much of a future. The old fox sniffed him right out, said Andres, admiring the prescience. He recognized Chavez's potential straight away, and his weaknesses. The seduction was captured in a series of photographs, the first in black and white, Fidel, in uniform and cap, welcoming his guest off the plane in 1994, gripping him by both shoulders, smiling, Chavez gazing up at his bearded host with awe. Castro personally attended to Chavez for the entire visit. The pair bonded over marathon talks where they compared life arcs. Both rural boys, talented pitchers who traded professional baseball dreams for politics and insurrection. An official photographer shadowed them, and Fidel gave his guest a photo album as a memento. In January 1999, they met again in Havana. More photographs. Chavez, now president-elect, in a brown suit and gold tie, walking down a shiny corridor with Fidel in olive green, deep in conversation. The 2002 coup, said Andres, provided the final push into Fidel's arms. It was right after that it happened. The Cubans took us over. He descended into the sala one morning to find strangers with rapid-fire Cuban accents. His new bosses. Cuba's intelligence service, G2, had thwarted countless plots against Fidel for decades. The Cubans considered Andres and his colleagues inept or disloyal. He reciprocated. The mess they made. Coffee cups everywhere, crumbs on the keyboards. That I could put up with. But then I saw their strategy. Seal Chavez off from the public, manipulate him, nourish his insecurity, find evidence of assassination plots, of betrayals, make him paranoid. Andres did not last long under the new bosses. He moved to the vice president's office as an analyst, then served in the Commerce Ministry, tax agency, and the state oil company. I lost my faith in this project a long time ago. A lot of us have. Teresita Rondon had landed a well-paying government job straight out of university. She was 8 years old when Chavez launched his coup, 15 when he was elected, and now, 7 years into his rule, 22. She had scored high grades in her information technology course and secured a post in the mayor's office. "The first in my class to get a job," she said proudly. When she was asked about her duties, the effervescent chatter turned taciturn. "Oh, you know, human resources, personnel, that sort of stuff." Then she would change the subject. Until one day, staring into her coffee in a quiet voice, she said, "La lista. The list." "That's what I do," she said, looking up. In mid-2003, opponents mounted another heave against the president, a petition to trigger a recall referendum, a mechanism enshrined in the new constitution to make authority accountable. Despite opposition leaders' complicity in the preceding year's coup and oil strike, a referendum stood a chance of success. The economy was flat, and Chavez's ratings had fallen. Even his base in the slums was restless. Organizers collected 3 million signatures. Chavez's allies in the National Electoral Council, supposedly an independent body, said the petition was flawed and demanded it be done again. It bought Chavez valuable months to plan a defense. As fresh signatures were gathered, he made what sounded like a threat. "Whoever signs against Chavez will be registered for history. Because they're going to have to give their name, surname, identity number, and fingerprint." After it was all over, Chavez admitted the throne had been in peril. "An international researcher spent 2 months here and came to the palace to deliver a devastating message. Mr. President, if the referendum were held today, you would lose. That for me was a bombshell. Because you know that many people will not tell you such things and will instead soften them. That was when we began to work with the missions and ask for help from Fidel. He told me, 'Look, I have this idea. Attack from below with all possible force.'" The idea was to create social programs for the poor to plug gaps in state services. They were called misiones, missions, and set up with speed and urgency. The timing was perfect, because oil prices spiked, largely due to Iraq's conflagration, and petrodollars rained on Miraflores. Chavez had never really cared about money, and Fidel had micromanaged his island's economy into penury. But they handled Venezuela's bounty with finesse. While Chavez sent 95,000 barrels of oil daily to Cuba, shoring up its economy, Fidel sent 20,000 Cuban doctors, nurses, and other specialists into Venezuela's barrios. They sought out the poor, sick, and forgotten, treated bulging veins, infections, broken bones, arthritis, bleeding gums, stiff backs. They logged medical histories, trained community volunteers, gave courses in nutrition. It was all free, and they stayed. Teachers followed to teach the illiterate to read and write, liberating thousands from embarrassment and ignorance. Other teachers taught night courses to high school dropouts. Credits and training were offered to small agricultural and industrial cooperatives. On it went. soup kitchens, subsidized food stores, land titles, flights to Cuba for eye surgery. By the time the referendum was held in August 2004, Chavez's ratings had recovered, and he won a landslide. "Venezuela has changed forever," he exulted to a crowd from the palace balcony. "There is no turning back." The opposition cried fraud, then collapsed. It felt cheated, crushed, and exhausted. Years of marching, chanting, plotting, organizing, for nothing. Chavez's power was now secure, but he was condemned to protect it, ceaselessly, endlessly. He had warned people not to sign the petition, and now they would pay. A digital record of the 3 million names was passed to Luis Tascon, a young National Assembly member and specialist in information technology. He posted it on his website, ostensibly to prevent the opposition from inventing signatories. Thus was born La Lista Tascon, the Tascon List, also known as Chavez's Revenge. It formalized the country's division, heretics this side of the ledger, believers on the other. Government and state offices used it to purge signatories from the state payroll, to deny jobs, contracts, loans, documents, to harass and punish, to make sectarianism official. People lost careers and livelihoods and went bankrupt. Fear gripped those who had signed, then it spread to their relatives. On his television show, the president invited Tascon onto the stage and with mock anxiety asked, "I don't appear on your list, do I?" By April 2005, the stories of blighted lives were creating an international embarrassment, so Chavez publicly declared a halt. "The Tascon list must be archived and buried," he said. "I say that because I keep receiving some letters that make me think that in some places they still have the Tascon list to determine if somebody is going to get a job or not. It had an important role at one time, but not now." A year later, Teresita Rondon confirmed the list was alive and well in Mérida. Her job was to apply it. The list, she said, had been transformed and expanded into a new software program called My Santa, after the Comandante's great-grandfather. It included all registered voters and allowed officials to check their addresses, voting stations, voting participation, political preferences, and memberships in missions and other government schemes. It rated people as patriots, opposition, or abstainers. The My Santa list was national. Chavez's order to bury it had been for the cameras. Rondon was one cog in a huge clanking machine. It bred a minor industry of corruption because data could be manipulated, she said. "I've heard of people who signed paying to become patriots. Those who couldn't afford the bribe stayed on the blacklist. It's not my fault. I didn't know this was the job. I can't look friends in the eye. Some of them are on the list. What am I going to tell them?" Her eyes reddened, and it seemed she would cry, but she didn't.
Comandante by Rory Carroll was abridged by Pete Nichols and read by Jack Claff. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. And the next part is tomorrow at the same time. After the news, Jodie Pico talks to Jenny Murray about her new novel. She'll also find out about doulas who help disadvantaged women give birth and look after their babies. And has feminism forgotten older women? Women's Hour with Jenny is in a couple of minutes. First, here's a trail for y'all.
I'm just walking out onto a viewing platform overlooking the vast open pit of one of the biggest new mine developments on the entire planet.
Justin Rowlett reports from Mongolia.
Hold on, one third of the entire country's GDP from this one mine.
Yes, that's right.
How will Mongolia manage its dramatic transformation?
How will this nation of traditional nomadic herders spend this incredible new wealth? That's Crossing Continents with me, Justin Rowlett, at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning.